Special thanks to C.H.R. Hansen, a leader in fermentation and innovative brewing solutions. C.H.R. Hansen's range of high-quality yeasts includes Smart Bev Near, which crafts flavorful beer entirely without the alcohol. These yeasts even enable fast, climate-friendly, and cost-efficient production. We thank C.H.R. Hansen for their support and commitment to excellence in brewing. This is the Master Brewers Podcast, brought to you by the Master Brewers Association of the Americas, a volunteer organization dedicated to continually improving the products and processes of our membership since 1887. Let's go! 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 Master Brewers brings you interviews with the industry's best and brightest in brewing science, technology, and operations.
Calm down, I'm moving too fast.
This episode was made possible by the following sponsors.
Discover more ways to enhance flavor and maximize beer yields with Salvo. Now available in varieties like Sultana, Trident, Lotus, Calypso, Cascade, and many more. Discover how Salvo can help boost your brew at hopsteiner.com.
Berkeley Yeast, creators of diacetyl-free yeast strains. Diacetyl-free strains are bioengineered to produce the ALDC enzyme inside the yeast cell to keep diacetyl low during fermentation and after packaging. Diacetyl-free strains create the cleanest flavor profile possible, which makes them the yeast of choice for the most exacting brewer. Go to berkeleyyeast.com to read about how brewers are using diacetyl-free strains to propel their beers to the top of the podium. Grist Analytics captures and trends data across the brewery so you can see issues as they are happening, not several batches later. Get real-time feedback on the brew deck, analyze correlations from the lab, and see scheduling predictions from anywhere. Connect Grist with your ERP platform to cover your brewery from production to finance.
Zipline Brewery in Lincoln, Nebraska, and Free State Brewery here in Kansas, Ivory Bill Brewery in Arkansas. There are lots of different breweries who are using Kernza.
And if you are trying to make a long-lasting hazy beer, like some of those hazy IPAs, maybe this is one of the choices you can try to include some.
Realizing that it is a unique grain is important to how it will be leveraged in the malting and brewing world.
This week on the show, we're talking about Kernza, an ingredient worth considering in your next recipe.
Hi, my name is Alexandra Diemer. I work for the Agricultural Utilization Research Institute based in Minnesota, and my role is in business supply chain development for novel crops.
Hi, I'm Tessa Peters. I am the Director of Crop Stewardship at the Land Institute in Salina, Kansas.
Hi, I am Harmony Bettenhausen, the director of the Hartwick College Center for Craft Food and Beverage in Oneonta, New York.
Hi, Xiang Yan here from Supply Chain Quality, Bought Malt, North America, based in the USA.
This is Juan Medina. I'm a malting scientist at the RAR Technical Center based in Shakopee, Minnesota.
All right, tell us about Kernza. What is it and why should brewers pay attention to it?
Okay, so Kernza is the trade name for the grain produced by intermediate wheatgrass, which is a forage crop originally from the Ukraine, Thinopyrum intermedium. And if that pronunciation is incorrect, please someone correct me. But this is a plant being developed as a perennial grain crop. And unlike traditional barley or rye or wheat that has to be replanted every year, Kernza is a perennial, meaning that it grows back year after year without the need for replanting. And this sort of offers people some alternative environmental and agricultural benefits, as we'll get into. And those unique characteristics really offer unique possibilities for malting and brewing and distilling. And I will say that the research and market for Kernza are both still developing, but those environmental benefits coupled with a lot of consumer interest in sustainable and nutritious foods offer some great economic opportunities for farmers and businesses. But we are still facing some challenges, as I'm sure we will get into.
Is Kernza pretty much the only perennial that you can malt, or is there anything else comparable?
At the moment, Kernza is one of the first, if not the first, commercially available perennial grains on the market. So it's pretty limited in the malting space. I think it's one of the first that's been explored.
Yeah, in general, I just think this perennial grain, it's giving good quality for malting, so the malting capability and also the brewing capability. And in general, the product that is giving gives relatively round flavor all around. So from that perspective, I think it's very good technically. But on the other side, on the other hand, I think it's the sustainability aspects, because it's really, I think we'll hear more, it's really good for the soil preservation and it's perennial. And then at the other end, it's good for new product development because of its unique flavor, etc. Of course, we have a lot of challenges we'll hear later on, and that's why we are here to discuss it.
So it doesn't sound like Kernza is necessarily new. Why are we just hearing about it now? Why is it, you know, where'd it come from all of a sudden?
Well, so Kernza has been domesticated. It's a newly domesticated crop for grain production. So intermediate wheatgrass has been grown in the U.S. for more than 100 years. It's native to Central Asia and was used there as a forage crop and then came to the U.S. as a forage crop. But there has long been a grass seed industry that has provided seeds. So our scientists at the Land Institute were really interested in exploring new perennial grain crops. And when they were exploring different potential grasses that could be used for grain production, Thinopyrum intermedium, which now makes the grain Kernza, was one that came to the top in terms of really responding to the selection for larger seed size and reduced shattering. And so it's really only been about 20 years that we've been working on the domestication of this grass. If you think about wheat or barley or these other grasses that we have these long relationships with, those relationships span, you know, 10,000 years. So Kernza is pretty new, and that's why you're just hearing about it.
Okay, awesome. Would you say, should I think of it as more similar to wheat or to barley, or you know, what makes Kernza unique other than being perennial?
Well, I think some of the malt people can really jump in about kind of the uniqueness of it in terms of how it behaves once malted, but in general, it is distinct from wheat or barley, and I think it's important for people to see it as its own product that has unique characteristics rather than, you know, a one-for-one replacement for some of those other grains.
Yeah, I would just add on to that in terms of like comparing it to its very distant cousin, which is wheat. Kernza has a higher level of protein, dietary fiber, and bioactive compounds like carotenoids, but it is lacking in some gluten. So there are some slight differentiation between, you know, if you're looking to put Kernza in the same box as wheat, there's going to be some differences in how it performs in like baking applications or brewing applications, some of which are potentially preferred and maybe better. So that's what we're exploring, at least at this point.
What's different about growing Kernza? Does it have a better value proposition to farmers?
For farmers, it's kind of a no-brainer. If you can plant a crop once and then harvest it three times without ever having to replant, that's something that farmers are definitely really interested in. That being said, you know, the yields on Kernza are lower than the yields in other grains like wheat and barley. So we, you know, at the Land Institute, we have a breeding program. We're really focused on improving those yields. And that's something that we're really focused on also in terms of just understanding the management and agronomy of the crop. So bringing those yields up will make, I think, more growers interested and will improve will increase the number of farmers and increase the number of acres of folks who are growing it, and will improve their economic livelihoods for sure.
Cool. I'm just curious, you said three. Was that an arbitrary number, or was there anything significant about that? You know, is it reasonable to plant this and you harvest it 20 seasons in a row, or is there some level of crop rotation that's still required here?
Yeah, crop rotation will still be required. There's definitely, we usually recommend for producers about 3 years of grain production. The grain yields decrease as the stand ages and you get kind of intraspecific competition. So it's competing with itself. And we're really working on understanding if there are methods of management that will increase the life of the stand. So, you know, can we burn it? Can we graze it? Can we do other things to reinvigorate the stand? But at this time, we're really recommending that folks imagine a 3 year grain production and then another year or two of forage production if they have a market either for the hay or have cattle who might be able to graze the stand.
Is it like barley where there's spring kernza and winter kernza? Does it only grow in certain regions?
There's no spring or winter. Most kernza is planted in the fall and then harvested in the summer. In really arid conditions, some growers are planting it in the spring, but it does need cold temperatures to trigger flowering, similar to winter wheat. So, yeah, most folks are planting in the fall, but there aren't two distinct varieties. It's all either fall planted or if you plant in the spring, you don't get a harvest that first year.
Tessa, I saw in a presentation you gave to, I believe it was Master Brewers District, Rocky Mountain, you had a image that showed the root system of kernza next to a typical annual winter wheat, and the root system was 3+ times the depth of the wheat. I don't know if that's after the first growing season or in year three or what, but comment on that, because that's obviously a pretty big difference that probably gets into some of the sustainability stuff, I would imagine.
Yeah, so the root structure is significantly longer than most annual crops. So, and that's just something that occurs from intermediate wheatgrass. So that is not a result of our breeding efforts to make it a grain crop. And yeah, after the first growing season, there are usually roots down at the 10 to 15 feet depth in the soil. So that is something that is really important in terms of the ecological benefits of kernza. So those deep roots are able to scavenge nitrogen out of a system that has surplus nitrogen and improve water quality by getting those nitrates out of water. They're able to increase the amount of carbon that is stored in the soil at those depths. It increases the amount of water infiltration into soils. These roots are really kind of the thing that all of the ecological benefits stem from. And so, this decrease in erosion, this increase in nitrogen consumption, that to be clear, like nitrogen that's already in the system. So a lot of places that have high nitrates in their well water or things like that could probably benefit from planting kernza and having it scavenge that nitrogen out of the system. Additionally, it's really, we have really strong evidence that there's the potential for carbon sequestration because of those roots that are increasing microbial activity and things at depth in soils.
All right, excellent. Does anybody else want to comment, add anything new about environmental benefits or anything along those lines?
Yeah, I think Tessa's comment on most of the good soil health benefits. I would also add that it can provide a really good food source and habitat for beneficial insects and pollinator species and provide food and shelter resources for wildlife. So it can also just kind of impact those adjacent ecological benefits to the farm itself.
Just to think that it's going to be very good for cover crop in the winter to prevent soil erosion, also particularly in the windy area and dry area. Over winter, we lose a lot of good topsoil, and this would definitely help. So that's another benefit I wanted to mention for the sustainability part.
I would also add that because of Kernza's ability to enhance its surrounding ecosystem, there are a lot of programs coming out both federally and at the state level to diversify economic opportunities by stacking some of these emerging market programs that reward farmers and ranchers who are implementing climate adaptive regenerative ag practices. So that can be an additional source of income, not just from potentially the sale of grain, but exchanging the value of those ecosystem services for like insetting or offsetting carbon, for example.
All right. Is the process for harvesting and storing Kernza similar to barley or wheat, or do you need a whole different set of equipment, or how does that work?
Yeah, it's pretty similar to barley or wheat. You can use the same sort of harvesting equipment. You do have to set it for this grain, which is a smaller size than the grain that barley and wheat produce. It's about, you know, maybe a third to a half the size of wheat. And so the equipment is the same, but it does need to be set appropriately for this smaller grain.
So post-harvest, there are also some things that producers will need to consider in their post-harvest handling procedures. Things like screening the seed, cleaning it, de-hulling it, and preparing it for storage. There are a number of equipment options that you can consider, but also potentially adding in other supply chain actors like seed cleaners, just to get that grain conditioned and ready to go into the supply chain.
You mentioned de-husking it. Is that necessary?
For the most part, Kernza does require cleaning and dehulling to prepare it for whole grain use. This is one of the larger challenges right now when it comes to processing Kernza, as the grain is smaller than an annual wheat and some of the other small grains. So it can require some specialized knowledge and machinery to process it. We've developed some of that in addition to some of the other supporting organizations in our area and with the Land Institute, the University of Minnesota, Northern Crops Institute. ARISE put together some spec sheets on post-harvest handling, and if folks are interested, they can find that on our website at auri.org. I know the Land Institute is also looking into some potential future areas of interest when it comes to this, but for the most part, dehulling is a necessary step.
Okay.
Yeah, and it may not be as important to dehull it for the malting, for malting. And so that's something that I know Alexandra and Juan probably have a little bit more information than I do, but it's possible that the germination will be improved by actually leaving it in the hull.
I guess my first experience with Kernza, it was the husk was pretty loosely attached. So I basically got a sample of it. And as I was handling it, noticed that the husks were coming off kind of with light handling. So I was in a position that I had to make a decision about how I would approach it. And I decided to manually dehull some of it and play with it like that. But I know that there is some work toward breeding it so that it is more free threshing and just loses its hull, similar to wheat. Or naked oats or naked barley like that. But it is definitely a vulnerable point when you're dehulling it that you might incur seed damage. So the embryo will be damaged or the grain will be broken.
I think you can certainly malt the dehulled Kernza, but still, when you are doing the brewing, it's likely that you would need to add rice husks also to facilitate the filtration. So if you're able to keep the hulls on for brewing, I don't think it's a bad thing. You just have to make sure if you want to keep the husks on, they should stay on all the way so they don't get the separation with the husks in the handling process between the malt house and the brewery. So the brewery may end up with half grain and half husks in the truck. So I think that's something we need to know, which direction we are going.
Yeah, this is one of the most important points, I think, in handling Kernza for malting perspective, because it maybe seems like a small detail, but whether or not the husk is intact and present is going to make a big difference. And it has to be uniform for the malting perspective, too, because you don't want to have some grain covered and some grain naked, because that husk actually is able to absorb and hold a lot of water. And if you don't have uniform hydration across the grain, you're going to have very inconsistent malt. So that's one of the actually primary challenges is deciding or pursuing a certain avenue, whether in-hull or de-hulled.
I would also add, Juan, from the report that you helped put us together back in 2022, you had mentioned that in full-scale malt production, the throughput of fermentable material is a lot more limited for Kernza that has a hull compared to the de-hulled, and that grain that was included in hull tended to separate and release during the mash process. So you have to be considerate of getting rid of those excess free hulls in the end as well.
Yeah, the hulls tend to separate almost at every step of handling. But yeah, you're right. I'm sure this is an issue for farmers as well, that it's more economical to store a denser grain. So the bushel weight, that being the amount of mass given in a certain volume of grain, the bushel weight is much higher in de-hulled Kernza, and that does give you a much better value proposition. So if you only have a limited amount of volume or space in your malt house, that's going to determine your total output. And de-hulled Kernza is almost twice as dense as Kernza in the hull, so that comes out to a big economical difference there for the maltster and for the brewer.
And from a breeding perspective, we are definitely moving toward a free threshing or naked Kernza seed, and the newer varieties are at least up to, you know, twice as free threshing as the older varieties. So I think we'll see that improve over the coming years and with newer varieties.
All right. Sounds like the direction has been chosen. As you alluded to earlier, Kernza doesn't have this luxury of the roughly 10,000 years of selection and breeding that has optimized barley for brewing. Talk about the current situation in regard to quality and what it takes in the malt house to convert Kernza into a useful ingredient in the brewery.
I think one of the biggest challenges we face right now is defining what quality means for Kernza. We do have all of these years of testing and knowledge for barley, for wheat, for other grains, and all of our methods for testing grains for quality also revolve around barley. So we really need to work on what quality means for Kernza in the raw grain form and what its uses are as a raw grain and in the malted form. We don't have a clear understanding of what modification means necessarily for this grain right now.
Earlier, we talked about the differences in from Kernza between like typical wheat or barley in the agricultural aspect, but like in the malting perspective, we'll look at Kernza as a raw grain and just notice that it has very, very high protein. So like Harmony mentioned, we don't really have like specifications or maybe a set of guidelines really for how we want it to look. So I think figuring out the ways to leverage its attributes for the best outcome is something we need to decide on. I think there's different ways of doing that, but definitely realizing that it is a unique grain is important to how it will be leveraged in the malting and brewing world.
And understanding that each year of quality may be different. In the case where we have this perennial and we have 3 years of seed development, each year will actually be different because of the root structure of the deep root system, which will draw on different nutrients. So the research we've done in our lab has, we looked at a number of different varieties from a number of different years. And that was definitely true that we saw different quality coming from different years and, of course, different varieties. But that's just something that's going to have to be taken into consideration, that what you get from a certain crop at a certain location may be a little bit different from year to year.
That's a great point, and I think that we'll see more consistent grain attributes and quality overall, like regardless of where the source and field and year are, or at least that's what I know to be true of the current breeding program. For example, like seed size has been something that Juan and I have discussed a lot in terms of like the different batches of pilot brews that we've done with Kernza and Rar Technical Center. And In the breeding program right now, their goal is to increase that seed size by about 50% of what the size of annual wheat is over the next 10 years. So it will grow, and that grain quality and consistency will become more uniform, which in the supply chain is great because it will kind of ease in product utilization for supply chain stakeholders to know what to expect when they're working with that grain.
Coming up.
We did have a keg that was kind of squirreled away for over a year. And when we went to pour it, it was still holding just an incredible haze.
I'm John Bryce, and you're listening to the Master Brewers Podcast from the Master Brewers Association of the Americas. There's really only one thing that keeps this podcast going, and that's when listeners like you take the time to thank our sponsors. The next time you talk to a rep from one of these companies, be sure to thank them for their generous support.
NC Hops LTD is a cooperative of master growers who, through their work with the New Zealand Plant and Food Research and the New Zealand Hop Research Committee, have delivered some of the most exciting hop varieties of recent decades. They're also known for sustainability, innovation, and exclusive experimental varieties. For the white wine character of Nelson Sauvin or the intense tropical fruit rush accompanying Nectaron, our Superdelic, visit bsgcraftbrewing.com and shop for NZ Hops LTD.
Get to know Proximity Malt. We malt superior, European-style, low-protein varieties grown close to home in Delaware and Colorado. Domestically grown, precisely malted to style. With our team of seasoned experts and two brand new malt houses, try what's really new in malt. Check us out at www.proximitymalt.com.
Positively impact your process, product, and profitability with actionable insights from BrewIQ, the industry-leading real-time fermentation monitoring solution. Visit www.precisionfermentation.com/MBAA to start saving time and money today.
BSI, your brewing partner since 1996, is your destination for top quality liquid yeast cultures, lab services, and brewing products. BSI customizes your yeast orders for the perfect healthy pitch rate from a collection of over 300 strains. Most strains ship within 7 days, but now try BSI's Express Yeast with industry favorite strains shipped the next business day. As of 2023, BSI is proud to be a 100% employee-owned business. Professional brewers can call for a free same-day consultation or visit brewingscience.com to access over 50 years of brewing expertise. Are you sure you're getting the best deal? Visit the Lupulin Exchange, where you can find every hop variety, every brand, and every vendor. Compare prices, reviews, shipping speeds, reliability, and more on over 1 million pounds shipping direct from every hop merchant and grower in the U.S. The Lupulin Exchange. One stop, all the hops. Are you headed to Vegas for CBC? If so, please come see me at the Lupulin Exchange, booth 1281, in between YCH and John I. Haas. I'll have an awesome free t-shirt for you while supplies last, and I'd love to hear about your experiences on the exchange, what we could do better, and how I can earn more of your brewery's business. And here's what's coming up on the Master Brewers calendar. District St. Paul, Minneapolis has a bowling social April 2nd at Town Hall Lanes. The District St. Louis Spring Quarterly Meeting is April 8th. District Rocky Mountain meets at Prost Brewing Company in North Glen April 10th. District Northwest meets in beautiful Hood River May 10th and 11th. The Master Brewers Brewery Maintenance Systems course begins June 6th. It's time to save the date for the 2024 World Brewing Congress. That's August 17th through the 20th in Minneapolis. And this year, the Master Brewers Brewing and Malting Science course runs September 5th through November 8th. Check out the full calendar of events at mbaa.com for more details or to find a district meeting near you. now back to the show. Okay, very good. You just mentioned pilot brews. Let's talk more about that, and let's hear about recipe formulation for brewers considering Kernza.
Well, I think this is very much depends on what style of beer or whiskey or other beverages you're making. We mentioned that the protein content is relatively high, so you are not going to use it alone to produce, for example, lager, because then you won't be able to get the clarity you wanted. But because of the high protein, therefore, you will be able to boost the content of, for example, the haze-forming protein. And if you are trying to make a long-lasting hazy beer, like some of those hazy IPAs, maybe this is one of the choices you can try to include some. And also, the malt gives relatively high viscosity. It's similar to wheat or a little bit higher. And it's going to add a lot of mouthfeel. So normally, I think the work, it's saying that we can include it at a relatively small portion, like 15-25% or so, in the grain bill, and you are able to complement those properties. And therefore, you still get the flavor impact from the Kernza. So this is very important to say, okay, when I talk about quality, what style of beer I'm talking about. Similarly, if you're using it for distilling, then you probably would need some high carbohydrate ingredient like corn or starch-heavy cereal also to include that into the grain bill. So you are not being hindered by, for example, the low alpha amylase in the Kernza malt and then the high protein as well. Some of those qualities like S over T, the soluble to total, in regular malt is definitely in the mid-40s, but in Kernza, because the high protein, you probably have it in the 30s. Therefore, it's very difficult to get the wort clear and then beer clear. So I think it's all relative. Juan was able to observe some of those and see how stable they are when you have the haze formed in the fresh beer. And this is one of the top priorities, I think. The advantages, I think you can see, yeah, we can leverage Kernza in it. Juan, you can add more on that.
Yeah. I think I'll add a little bit of context there. It was a really great summary there. I think it's interesting to look at how Kernza has been widely used already in craft brewing. So the Patagonia program has a lot of people doing the Pilsner at a small inclusion rate. And like Sheng said, it's maybe not the most beneficial way of using the Kernza. I mean, I think it's great to just to get it in involved in any brewing, but the attributes of Kernza are really unique, and leveraging the properties of the Kernza to your advantage rather than fighting them, I think makes a lot more sense. So as Sheng mentioned, hazy beer is a really easy low-hanging fruit, but I would add that you know, when you brew any beer, you got to think about the ingredients as a factor in the style that you're brewing. So if we think about other alternative grains, so wheat has its own categories and its own category guidelines. Rye beer is its own category and has its own category guidelines. There are adjuncts used in different styles, but you might want to think of Kernza as a adjunct that might be kind of guiding the style itself. So the high protein is an obvious candidate for inclusion in hazy beers, whether that's a hazy IPA or maybe a take on a wheat ale or a vit. But similarly, you can leverage those properties for malting. So, you know, if you're malting the Kernza, you can have an idea of where the end use is going to be. So if you want to use it just for its protein as an inclusion in a hazy IPA, you probably want the lightest color possible with a lot of available protein. So you wouldn't want to kiln it very highly and you'd want to keep some enzymes. But alternatively, you could try to leverage that protein for flavor precursors. So the more modified the malt is and then highly kilned, you can get a lot of flavor and color. So that's some of the malting stuff we're looking at. Maybe going down the road here. But as Sheng mentioned earlier, we did do a brew here at the RAR Technical Center a few years ago that focused on the hazy style. And we didn't do a formal shelf stability trial on it, but we did have a keg that was kind of squirreled away for over a year. And when we went to pour it, it was still holding just an incredible haze. It really looked better than anything else I've ever seen stored that long. So we didn't have a sampling over time to monitor the haze, but it was pretty astounding at how well it retained the haze.
That's cool. Sounds like there might be some interesting opportunities for maybe some small scale malters to, you know, make some interesting Munich malts and other specialty malts utilizing that high protein, right?
Right. Yeah, you have a lot of opportunity for flavor and color precursors when you have that much protein available. So we were getting pretty moderate, like 5 to 7 Lovibond color without even hitting it with much high heat at all, and a relatively low S over T. So if you really push that modification, you could definitely get a lot of color and a lot of flavor without much energy.
All right.
If we could back up 1 second, and I could be the Negasaurus Rex of this conversation. Uh-oh,
here it comes.
Here it comes. I just want to focus a little bit on milling. You know, this is, and I know that earlier we did mention the seed size, and that is going to be improved soon. But currently, for people looking to use Kernza in their recipes, just think about how you're going to mill this small seed. It may involve a different mill. It may involve changing your mill settings, which I know so many people love to do anyway. But just taking that into consideration, I mean, if you can't grind malt, there's no way to expose the enzymes, and that's sort of an ineffective way to brew.
Do you have any information? So I want to hear more about the Patagonia beer series, because I was just looking that up a few minutes ago, and you know, there's obviously quite a few breweries producing this beer, you know, some big names. Do we have any information about how they are milling this grain?
So I believe they're using raw Kernza, probably in a flaked form. I'm not sure though. I think some of them are actually milling it on their own. I've talked with a local brewery, and they were just closing their gap as far as possible and just, you know, working with that as well as they could. But it is, as Harmony said, an extreme challenge with milling. I mean, that's something that we struggled with here. And in our pilot brews, we did use laboratory mills to get the malt milled down properly. I think hammer mills are a good option too, but you have to, like Sheng said earlier, maybe include some rice hulls for filtration, but it's not an easy challenge.
Yeah, and I think the Patagonia beer series is using it as a whole grain. There is flaked grain available in the marketplace, but to my knowledge, the supplier that they're using doesn't have flaked grain available. So I know that there is flaked grain available, but it's not, but currently it's not regenerative organic certified. So the Patagonia beer series is using all regenerative organic certified grain.
Okay. I want to get into that in a second, but I guess I should ask, just in terms of the breeding efforts and whatnot, I mean, given the small seed size, is there a concerted effort to trying to increase that, or is that, or is it better, is it you know, is that a primary objective in terms of optimizing this grain?
Definitely seed size is the number one breeding target to increase that seed size. And we're able to get 2 cycles of selection per year. So we estimate that it'll be about 17 years before we are at the same size as wheat. But for plant breeding, that's actually a pretty short amount of time. So it's kind of a different world. But yeah, if you consider that it took 10,000 years to get wheat where it is, you know, another 17 years to get Kernza to that same size doesn't feel like too big a goal.
Can I just ask about the increase in grain size, Tessa, does that come commensurate with bigger yield, or does that is that kind of an independent variable that you're working
on? No, it's directly related to yield.
Yeah.
So we look at seed size and then at the number of seeds as well. But seed size is the number one way that we're increasing yield at this point.
So as you increase seed size, you're not sacrificing number of seeds per head.
Right. You're getting bigger seeds at each floret.
All right. Let's hear about those Patagonia beers. Tell us about that.
As Tessa was saying, I know there were about a dozen breweries across the nation last year that they enrolled in that program. They were purchasing grain from a farmer cooperative that's based in, I guess, 8 states now, the Perennial Promise Growers Cooperative, and mainly for regenerative organic grains. They are expanding that program into their second pilot year this year, and it's had a lot of success moving forward. So we're excited to see how some of the media attention and consumer experiences of those beers across the nation will increase more demand for beverages with Kernza included.
For that program, were all of these different breweries making the same beer, or were they all, or were they making different beers with Kernza?
My understanding is that they're all making the same beer. It's the same recipe.
Yeah, it's all pills.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pills. And then there are many breweries, in other places across the nation that are using Kernza. So Zipline Brewery in Lincoln, Nebraska, and Free State Brewery here in Kansas. There Ivory Bill Brewery in Arkansas. There are lots of different breweries who are using Kernza. So it's really available, and if folks are interested in using it, I know that my local brewery in Laramie, Wyoming, is going to brew on Friday with Kernza. So there's definitely grain available, and it can be used, I think, pretty easily in recipes that already exist for breweries, and they can try it that way. It's sort of low-hanging fruit to try it in a recipe that you already have established, and then think about how that adjunct might guide you to a new recipe and to really enhancing the flavor using Kernza.
All right, that's exciting. Let's get into some of the sensory stuff. So let's hear more about what brewers can expect. I've not had the opportunity to have any of these beers you just mentioned. So if you're familiar with some of them, maybe also comment on sort of, anything you've observed from a sensory standpoint in any of these beers, and any different directions people have gone, whether they've used it to supplement a certain attribute or whether they've tried to really feature the whole flavor of Kernza. So I'd love to hear more about all of that.
I think we can probably distinguish between the raw Kernza and the malted Kernza. So at this point, pretty much all the breweries using Kernza are using it in a raw or flaked form. But as far as I know, malted Kernza used at breweries has primarily come from us. And correct me if I'm wrong, anyone else on the call. But so we did a brew here. Sheng was part of that, and as he mentioned, it really has a great mouthfeel, so that's one aspect from a sensory perspective. But the Kernza itself produces kind of an elusive spicy note when it's malted, so similar to like the subtle spice you get from rye. It's something in that ballpark, but we weren't quite able to nail it down, so we're thinking it comes from similar to the ferulic acid pathway for rye that ultimately leads to a biotransformed spicy note. But that was definitely one unique aspect we got out of the malted Kernza in the beer. Other notes that you get, I'm sure in the raw and the malted Kernza are some nutty kind of earthy flavors as well.
Yeah, I think if you're using malt, maybe the flavor note is a little bit different. I think once it's malted, it definitely gives this sweetness, more like honey, also caramel also. And then I think as far as the spicy note, it's not very strong like that from rye. There's a little bit like a clovey and a white pepper note, but it's quite mild and quite acceptable to me. Apricot is not a note coming through, I think if you talk about the flavor note spiciness, you can think of wheat that gives you this clovey note. It's quite strong in the 4VG note. And rye, because of the strong phenolic compounds, is quite spicy. Even you see some of the colors come through the rye. And with Kernza, you see this is a more round note on the spiciness touch, and I think the nuttiness comes through together with the rich mouthfeel. To me, it's a really very acceptable impact from the flavor perspective and mouthfeel perspective to the general beer. I think that could be one of the advantages we can leverage in producing new product or innovative beverages.
I'm curious if anyone can speak to the Tattersall Kernza whiskey.
That was a pretty limited production run, but they were using 100% Kernza. I unfortunately did not get my hands on a bottle myself, and they are sold out. But I heard, you know, great feedback from those that were able to, as far as what I read in media articles.
I got a bottle.
Oh, you did?
I did. And I mean, not a big whiskey drinker, but it was very good. And my husband, who is a big whiskey drinker, really enjoyed it. So that's what I can say.
Was it barrel aged?
Yes. Alexandra, do you know how long it was aged for? I think it was a couple of years.
Yeah, it wasn't a short age. And actually, Ida Graves, based in Alexandria, Minnesota, is working on a bourbon formulation right now as well. So watch for that coming out.
Yeah, and there's another whiskey from Smoky Hill Distillery here in Kansas, and one from Isco out in Rhode Island. And Ventura Spirits has also had a Kernza whiskey in days past. So there are definitely a lot of folks who are experimenting with it.
I wanted to just quickly elaborate before we move on too much. To continue on some of what Tessa was saying, there have been a lot of pilot breweries here based in Minnesota that have really contributed to the knowledge sharing and continued exploration of what's needed in the supply chain. So I just want to give more kudos to all of the pilot brewers all across the nation that have really contributed to figuring out where to go next in brewing and in distilling.
Yes, absolutely.
What is the Valley of Death, and how does Kernza traverse it?
Yeah, the Valley of Death is a concept in commercialization or in new product launch, where you know you have to get things from being primarily funded by research organizations and the government and other sorts of private. Or other sorts of public funding into kind of the private sphere where businesses can actually make money by growing, selling, and just engaging in market commerce around this grain. And yeah, Kernza is definitely very, very squarely trying to traverse that. It's a really difficult path. And one of the things to remember is that while we talk about the Valley of Death in grains, the valley sort of never ends. Like, you know, corn is subsidized heavily by the U.S. government. So the idea that a grain ever goes from public support all the way to private support is not really feasible. But on the other hand, we're really interested in figuring out, you know, how can we get Kernza to be an economic boon for producers and to contribute to their livelihoods, as well as making sure that we're moving into a place where folks are buying it and eating it and all of those things. So right now, I think it's really important for consumers to understand that, you know, all of the things that this grain is doing for the environment, and hope that that makes an impact on the kind of decision making that consumers make. That being said, you know, it is just really hard to enter this kind of commodity grain space without the kinds of public support, government programs, et cetera, that exist for other grains. I will say the USDA has been a good partner, and the NRCS has a couple of programs that do support perennial grains and perennial grain growing on acres. So there are some public programs. The state of Minnesota also has an economic clusters of opportunity program that is paying growers to plant Kernza and helping mitigate risk by providing market failure payments and things like that. So there are these innovative programs, but we definitely want to see the market pull become stronger and have more consumers who are demanding Kernza in products like beer.
Okay. All right. I guess I'll ask each of you to pull out your crystal ball and tell us what the future of Kernza looks like.
Well, I will start. I think for Kernza's future, it's going to be a long-term play. If you're looking for the economic return, it's not going to be right away or in the next decade or so. However, if you look at the innovative aspects for the product, and if you look at the sustainability aspects, I think there's a lot of good attractions there. And also from the longer term, here we are talking about beverages mainly. I think we could certainly push it into the food, other food more broadly and beverage field as well, in the form of maybe raw, but also sprouted grain. So that means you may not fully grown it to shoots and sprout, but just activate the enzyme system. Because if you think about the grain, the raw kinds of grain, it's carbohydrate you're thinking about, it's fiber. But if you think about sprouted, the grain shoots, you're thinking about vegetable, the nutrients, the vitamins, which is true. So there's a lot of increasing the phytochemicals through the germination process. We just have to control it so we don't lose all the carbohydrate into the grass and roots. So I think there's a lot of areas we can explore, but it's probably not going to give us a lot of commercial benefit right away if that's your expectation. But it will need people to dedicate their time and effort to work on it, and then we'll be able to get to the future with good profit, good profitability, but also good products for the consumers.
Yeah, I agree with Zhang. With any grain, we have to look at the long game. I think if we can work to define and understand the biochemistry, quality, and functionality for malting, brewing, baking, distilling, we'll be in a pretty good spot with our end users. I think there's a lot of education that needs to happen around that. We, for example, have a lot of interest from our bakers in using Kernza, a lot of interest in understanding its functionality and how to use it.
And I can jump in here from a like maltster's perspective, because I've done quite a bit of work with Kernza here at RAR for malting, and we've done some brewing and distilling experiments. We have more malting experiments on the horizon here, working with Alexandra and AURI. But I think the takeaway, from RAR's perspective, it's not going to be something that's implemented on an industrial scale here. So if anyone's going to be malting it, it's going to be craft maltsters, and I think in particular floor maltsters would have the best go at it. Being able to work with small harvests directly with farmers, that's the opportunity and advantage that craft maltsters have. So they can do one-off pieces and tailor their process to the grain much more easily. And then moreover, if you're doing floor malting, you're able to kind of sidestep some of the challenges that you get from handling. So I think if we do see it in malting commercialized, it's going to be in that kind of aspect. But more realistically, the quickest way to get Kernza in the hands of brewers in a way that they're going to use it is going to be through flakes. I think that's something that's familiar to brewers. They know how to use it, and it allows for a lot of versatility in its application.
I think, Juan, you're bringing up a great point one of the two things I'm thinking about is in terms of the future is what does our infrastructure along the supply chain look like, especially at that early stage in kind of transforming this ingredient for use in other applications down the road for higher value added products. And thinking about malting and milling and even seed cleaning a step before that, we just need a lot more small and middle-sized, regionally based infrastructure developments or maybe adaptations to current existing businesses. But it'd be great if there were some Kernza-specific businesses that were interested in taking on this supply chain. And I think in capitalizing on that, you know, having those be near where the grain is produced limits that transport cost and emissions and all of the things that help continue to make this a very climate-friendly product. Those infrastructure developments are going to be really key to getting more grain moved and into the hands of more makers to create things like specialty products, baked goods, brews, distilled liquors, things like that. The other piece, and Tessa can probably elaborate on this as well and what in terms of what TLI is forecasting, but there have been some really promising changes recently to the price of grain, which, as many of us know who work in the Kernza space, has been a really big constraint for a lot of supply chain stakeholders. So this recent shift in thinking about how pricing is going to happen or how marketing is happening, in major part because of the Perennial Promise Growers Cooperative and MAD Agriculture, who markets their grain. Conventional grain has been set at about 50% less than it was. Organic is about 25% less, and regenerative organic is also about 25% less. So you'll see that showing up in a more positive way for those that felt maybe excluded from working with it because their grain bill will be a little bit cheaper to try and include Kernza at different rates. So I think that's going to be really promising.
All right.
Yeah, I think that's true, Alexandra. I think that the price coming down a little bit is going to help. I think we're seeing producers getting a lot better at producing Kernza, that, you know, they're learning a ton and sharing with one another, and that's making their yields go up. We're also seeing, you know, really promising signs for building that kind of infrastructure. So, you know, there are a lot of programs right now that are available for building that kind of infrastructure in terms of grants and things like that, which is not always the case. So I'm really excited to see all of the progress that's going to happen. I'm really excited to see producers hopefully being able to make a living growing this grain and to transition their acres from annual agriculture that is, you know, extracting of the soil and extracting of them as land managers and to a more sustainable and regenerative crop.
Creating a critical mass for the market is going to be good for the consumers to at least know what is Kernza. And of course, malting it is good, like it's good job security for Juan and myself, but rolling the oats and then making it into the food stream is probably not a bad idea to get the production going. Thank you.
Yeah, and I can just say to build on that, you know, flaked grain is available from Sustain-A-Grain. And so their flaked grain is available now and ready for purchase.
That was Alexandra Diemer, Harmony Bettenhausen, Tessa Peters, Xiong Yin, and Juan Medina here on the Master Brewers Podcast. As always, check the show notes for links, and somebody please bring me a Kernza beer to booth 1281 at CBC in Vegas. Are you enjoying the Master Brewers Podcast? Let me tell you about a simple way you can help us keep making more. Take a minute to thank our sponsors. There's no way we could produce this show without generous support from sponsors like Hopsteiner, Proximity Malt, BSG, Precision Fermentation, and the Lupulin Exchange. So please, let them know you heard their message on the Master Brewers Podcast and that you appreciate their support.